Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends, this week. As always, Happy New Year. Yeah, I know we're a little bit into 2020, but this is our first show here at the NOLA Drink Show of the new year. So there you go. Hope everyone had a great holiday season and great new year. And got a great show coming up for you here today to kick things off. We're starting with the bang here in 2020. We're going to be chatting with two of the most noted cocktail historians on the face of the earth, Jeff Beachbum Berry and David Wondrich. Dave was in town. Jeff, of course, is here in New Orleans, operates Latitude 29 with his lovely wife, Anine. So Jeff is a friend of the show and on quite a bit, as you probably know. And Dave, this will be his second stint on the show. He lives in New York, but he was down here visiting over the holidays briefly, and he was kind enough to give us some time. Those two guys are good friends. And like we did in July, go check out that show if you didn't. I believe it aired on July 29th. Really a fun show then. We have a great time on this one, too. Talk about some interesting stuff. We talk about the Saturn, a lost tiki cocktail, and the man behind it. We talk about bouillon-based cocktails, all kinds of cool stuff coming up. We tape that over at Bella Pock Friends. Want to flag your attention to that fine establishment. Pretty new place. A sultry, elegant absinthe lounge and restaurant hidden behind the historic old Absinthe House, 240 Bourbon Street. And it's really, it's a great place. Go check out the Absinthe program, cocktail program going on there. Our good friend, beverage director, Laura Bellucci, who makes a little celebrity walk on during the show coming up here in a bit. She's killing it in the beverage program. Haley Van Fleet, super talented chef, killing it in the kitchen. Want to encourage you to go check them out. They're open Thursday through Sunday. On Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday, they open at 6 p.m. and they close at 2 a.m. And on Fridays, they open a bit earlier. They open at 2 p.m. and they're open until 2 a.m. So go check them out. Thursday through Sunday, Bella Pock, 240 Bourbon Street. Used to be the Tony Moran's dining room, if you're familiar, but it's right there behind Old Absinthe House at the corner of Bienville and Bourbon in the French Quarter. Got a great show coming up for you next week. Also, we're going to be chatting with some folks connected to the Turning Tables program, which is a really, really cool program designed to give persons of color here in New Orleans an opportunity to work in the bartending world. So bartending skills, employability skills, job placement stuff. Everybody's paired up with a mentor who's an experienced bartender. They get opportunities to work behind the bar in different types of bars. And then they work with them to then find jobs. We have a shortage of labor in the hospitality industry, including in the bartending world, yet something like 1 in 5 persons, young people of color, are either not in school or not working. So it's a great program to kind of bridge that gap and give people an opportunity to work behind the bar. We talk about all kinds of interesting stuff that's connected with that program. So be sure to check that one out next week. And we're very excited for some things coming up here in 2020 on the NOLA Drink Show. You'll see some different things that we're going to be doing as we move forward. We're going to have some great shows coming up for you, as we like to think that we always do. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Then we're going to be back over at Bella Pock chatting with Jeff Beachbum Berry and David Wondrich. Don't go anywhere. Come on. All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here at WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. Our first show of 2020. As you know, Happy New Year, and we are pleased to be here at Bella Pock, the very fine Absinthe Lounge and restaurant tucked nicely right behind the old Absinthe House. And I'm pleased to be joined by my two friends, David Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry. Welcome back to the show, guys. How you doing?
All right. Happy All right. to be here.
Great to be here. Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too.
Yeah, thank you very much. And as we're taping this, we're right on the heels of New Year. So,
whenever there's a heel, I'll be there.
I think you just called me a heel, Jeff.
We're tottering on the heels.
We're tottering on the heels. That's right.
Okay, so here's an important question then. At what point is it no longer acceptable to say Happy New Year? What day does that end?
May 7th.
May 7th? Okay. That's even after the Chinese
New Year. I'm a little slow.
Okay.
I mean, that's going by my email.
The email responses. Email Happy New Year's May. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. I'll take it.
About when I'll get to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And at what point do we start, assuming y'all still write checks, when we start not writing 2019 on the dateline of the checks?
See, that's a good one, too. I jacked that one up several. Well, that's a good question, because I write like one check a month now. So
I think it's February for me.
I think I'm still signing 2006.
This explains a lot. I mean, yeah, Dave just responded to my November email after the last show.
Historians don't do very well with the present.
You know? No. Yes. I like dead people.
They make a living that way, Jeff.
That's right.
It's a great
dead
point.
Dead people never email you.
Dead people never
email you.
And they don't ask you for money.
They don't ask you for money.
I'm sorry, Dave, because I'm sure it's a disappointment. It's like, oh, that guy, he's still alive when I send you an email. But
I make exceptions for my friends.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate that. Well, it's great to see you guys, and we're kind of just, you know, as we always joke about here on the NOLA Drink Show, quality pre-production, which was about a 30-second conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're kind of, I don't know, we're talking about holidays. Dave, you just got into town. Let's talk about that.
I came down on the 30th, got in the evening, and I've been just having a couple days to get away from New York and go somewhere different, you know? And, I mean, if you're going to go somewhere different, New Orleans is different.
Mm-hmm.
It's always fun for me to come down here. I've always got a list of all the drinks I want to have, and I've been checking them off rigorously. I mean, this is about the only rigorous thing I do in my life. But I'm like, check, 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 check. Go to Latitude 29. Have a Saturn. Check. That thing messed me up for hours. That is a big drink.
You start seeing rings everywhere you go.
Really?
So
really?
Let's work. Jeff, if you're cool with this, let's work off Dave's checklist.
Let's do
of drinks. So the Saturn. Let's talk about that.
Well, Dave can actually speak well about the Saturn these days because he just did like a ton of research on the guy who invented it, Bocco Galsini, which he was kind enough to share with me. And the only research I had done was I discovered the drink, which was a lost recipe, never been published that I know. I think you found a published version though in the newspaper. But the only reason that it's in tiki bars now and that it's become the famous gin tiki drink alternative that it is because I was in a thrift shop with my wife in around 1993-94 in Oceanside, Ocean Beach, outside of San Diego.
Yeah.
And at that time, you could go into a thrift store and for 10, 15, 25 cents, just get the coolest vintage glassware. And I sort of had no room left for any of it, but I did find a double old-fashioned glass, which had the IBA logo on it, International Bartenders Association. It had the California Bartenders Guild logo on it. And it said 1967, I believe, IBA champion drink, the Saturn, by Bocco Galsini. And it had the recipe on it, just printed on it. And it was like a commemorative glass, I guess. And I did not, and to my dying day, I'm going to regret this, I did not spend the 25 cents it would have taken to buy the glass. And I've never seen it since anywhere online in the virtual world and in the real world. And we didn't have cell phones, and I just copied down the thing. There's no photo of the drink or of the glass, rather. And I went home, and I made, and it sounded pretty tropical, falernum and orgeat and all that stuff, and gin, which was intriguing, because you don't find too many gin tea drinks. Yeah. And it was an award winner.
Mm-hmm.
So I made it, and it was just terrible. But there was no indication on the glass of how to prepare it, and it was a very short drink. I mean, the whole thing came to about 2 ounces, 3 ounces mm-hmm. max, as listed. So I thought, well, obviously it's a cocktail. I mean, so I shook it and strained it, and it was just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of that. Just filed it, put it in a drawer. And at least 10 years later, 2005, 2006, I met this guy named Bob Esmino. And I was interviewing him for the book Sip and Safari because he used to work for all kinds of people back in the day. And in the course of the interview, he starts mentioning the California Bartenders Guild, which he was one of his proudest days was being made a member. At that point, the California Bartenders Guild was like a medieval guild. It was like, I don't know, 8,000, 10,000 bartenders in California, but there were only 80 members at any one time.
Wow.
You had to distinguish yourself to become a member.
I think you needed two guys to nominate you and you had to serve a six-month trial period. I don't know what you had to do during that trial period other than just show up for work.
Kill an existing member.
Blood in, blood out.
Yeah. It's like, yeah.
So, what years are we talking here, like, where this was the case, roughly?
Well, when I was talking, 60s. But anyway, long story short, and then we'll throw it over to Dave, because Dave's the one who really broke this thing open, and is that... when I was talking to Bob Esmino, he starts mentioning his idol, Popo Goscinny, and he talked about him in very hushed, respectful tones, and about all the awards he'd won, and he, you know, I thought, oh, that's the Saturn guy, you know. So I said, did you ever make a Saturn? He goes, no, I never did, but he did. He was kind enough to let me Xerox a recipe book put out by the California Bartenders Guild in the 70s, and it had every IBA and UKBG, and when they started to have one, the USBG award-winning drink that a California Bartenders Guild member had competed in and won from like the 1950s on. Wow. And there was the Saturn, and it said, you know, blend with ice and pour. And it's like, oh, tried that, and it was delicious.
Interesting.
And then finally published it, you know, in 2009, I think.
Okay. So, for people who don't know, including myself, Dave, I mean, Jeff just kind of ran down the drink. But what is the drink?
It's gin. It's almond syrup. You know, orgeat.
Okay.
Passion fruit puree, right? Orange juice or pineapple juice.
There's as I recall,
it's like a mix of juices.
Yeah, it's gin, lemon. Falernum and orgeat,
which is interesting, and
that may be it.
Okay.
That may be it, but you blend it with a lot of ice, and it, you get it, you still get a very short drink. So what we did at Latitude is we doubled it, which is why that knocked you on your ass, and to get a
thank you for that.
Yeah, and also because we're all beauty queens. We had to make a nice garnish, so we took a planet sized ice ball and then put an orange ring around it and made it Saturn.
Nice.
And for that you needed a big snifter. So another reason the drink was so big.
I like how the garnish dictates the drink, the shape and size of the drink. That's good.
It was totally delicious. But
beauty before age and taste and all that.
I do recall in the USBG chapter here 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 8, 9 years ago now, I say offered a seminar on advanced garnish. We can leave that where that is.
Yeah.
What are you going to say, Dave?
I was going to say I had come across this drink in Jeff's books and just kind of go, well, that's, you know, another bartender I never heard of. And I was looking up something. I was doing a little research into this guy, Johnny Durlesser, who was the head of the California Bartenders Guild and kind of the top dog bartender in Southern California in the 50s and 60s. He might have been the guy. He was certainly the guy who popularized the margarita and may have been the guy who named it. And it hit at his bar.
So not Jose Cuervo.
No. Well, Jose Cuervo, he used Jose Cuervo.
Okay.
And Jose Cuervo saw that they were selling all this tequila at the bar of the Tail of the Cock, which was a society steakhouse. Like very Tony Steakhouse, and they're going, oh, what's up with this? So they sent somebody around. It was actually Young's Market, the distributor, sent somebody around and saw this drink was just flying off the bar. They said, what the hell is going on here? So they put it in an ad campaign, and next thing you know, we're all drinking margaritas. So
I didn't know that.
So I'm looking up Johnny Durlesser, and I see, wait, that's a picture of the legendary Popo Goscinny right there. You know, and I was like, what's that doing here? And I started looking and seeing, let me see if I can find out some more in some, you know, newspaper archives and stuff. And next thing you know, I had this, I can never predict, but sometimes I just get like obsessed with something. Mainly it's, I guess, a way of escaping the fear of death. And
well, that's what Samuel Johnson wrote.
Yeah.
He said, the whole of life is but keeping away thoughts of death.
Exactly.
And it's like, that's why,
So I started, you know, digging into this, and I ended up with this whole file of stuff about Popo Goscinny, and I got mildly obsessed and started, you know, going on Ancestry.com and all that kind of stuff. And I found it. It's just the wildest, most like Thomas Pynchon-like story. This guy was a chameleon, and he popped up everywhere. And you know, his famous drink is only famous from a document that does not exist. And, you know, there's all this just weird stuff. So I wrote, it's going to come out this week. I wrote this huge, long, insane story about him in Southern California in the 50s and 60s and bartending and all that kind of stuff because I just couldn't stop myself. But his life, this guy was born in the Philippines in 1900.
Okay.
And came to America as a ship's bartender in 1928 on a Japanese passenger liner and jumped ship in San Francisco. Next thing he pops up is, I'm pretty sure it's him, he pops up in Brooklyn a year later marrying an 18-year-old who had been in convent school until like a couple years before, judging by what it says on Ancestry.com, and then became a telephone operator and marries this guy, you know, 10 years her senior. Then we don't hear anything about him. Then he pops up in 1939, rather, so 11 years later, marrying a 20-year-old in Utah on January 3rd, 1939, under his real name, which was Jose Galsim, a Philippine guy. Mm-hmm. And then he turns up 5 months later marrying a 17-year-old at that same place in Utah, and now he's going under the name Joseph Galsini, which is close enough to Galsim, you could say it's a typo.
It's a typo, okay.
But you know, because he was like, I'm going back there. I don't know what happened to his first two wives there.
Well, one might assume by where he was, Dave, that there may be them both operating or existing at the same time in the same
space. Oh, yeah, exactly so. Exactly so. But that third wife he stays married to up until the late 50s. So he finally kind of gets over his ways. But, you know, he was considerably older than these young ladies. So there's a little.
He definitely established a pattern.
Yeah, he definitely established a pattern of behavior, which was, you know, and this was how he spent his youth and his early middle age. Because then in the late 40s, he pops up and he's bartender at all these tiki bars. The Hollywood Tropics in Hollywood, which was, you know, a kind of a rip-off, fairly crappy tropical bar. He's there, and then he's at Kelbo's Hawaiian Rib Joint, which... old timers from Southern California always remember for their delicious pineapple ribs, but that place was, you know, pretty low rent at the same time. And then he starts kind of moving to he's the opening bartender at a tiki bar in Phoenix, Arizona, the islands.
Yep.
And then he's back at several bars in Southern California. Meanwhile, he's like winning competitions or coming in second, third, fourth, like over and over again. He's always, he's not always, but usually he shows up in the money at these competitions and like wins grand prize in 1953 and then again in 67 with the Saturn. And he goes on, and then Tiki dies, and he's first at the Disneyland Hotel for a year or two, wins another competition and goes to Tokyo. And then he's at the first hyper fine dining restaurant in Orange County, California, which had been kind of suburban cookie cutter suburban, you know, in the post-war years, and then suddenly got really rich and became really rich and Republican. And he's there at this restaurant where they give you a velvet footstool for your purse for the ladies.
Is that
Ambrosia, it was called.
Oh, okay, that's not the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah,
okay.
And anyway, and so he's there, and, you know, this is in the 76, he's 76 years old, and he's like the star bartender there. And then he ends up at a bar in Laguna Beach, this former artist colony that also got really rich. This little tiny bar where on his 81st birthday, all the young women regulars are wearing Popo 1981 T-shirts and they're having like drinks in the bar. You know, I mean, it's like this guy doesn't miss a trick. Somebody interviews him that you could tell the writer was she was charmed by him. You know, and he said he doesn't look a day over 55.
Hey Dave, hold on. Let's do this, guys. Yeah. Let's take a little break here. It's amazing that he didn't get arrested for statutory. But yeah. I guess it was
he kept it fairly legal.
That we know. Oh, right, fair enough. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Friends are chatting with Jeff Beachbum, Barry, and David Waters. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in to the NOLA Drink Show. Drink Show, friends. Happy New Year. Yeah, I'll say it. It's still 2 weeks removed when you're hearing this. We are here at Belle Epoque, the very fine Absinthe Bar, located right behind the old Absinthe House. And we are sipping on a Low Key and Barnaby, a very fine absinthe drink created by our lovely friend Laura Bellucci. We're waving at Laura right now. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Laura.
Who is the beverage director and our host here today. Really nice drink, Laura. You said with lucid absinthe, coconut rum, tobacco bitters, and lime.
Yeah.
I didn't write that down.
Perfect.
Sweet.
All right.
All right. And now I've forgotten it
now
already.
We're putting
what
you
the hell
behind
I just
the bar.
Said. No one wants. They'll wait. Dave, they will wait 30 minutes for a drink. This is not New York, man. Because it's not going to be that good. There's not going to be like the carved dolphin porpoise with pineapple garnish.
Really?
Advanced. No. It's not going to happen.
Now, Loki and Barnaby, are we talking about Norse mythology mashed up with Herman Melville? Or
tell us, Laura. Come here. Come here. Come here. Tell us.
We're talking about Dogma, so the movie Dogma. The movie
okay.
Fallen Angels.
Okay. I thought it was Loki with a K and Bartleby as in Bartleby the Scrivener. So.
Yeah. I love okay. that Loki too. He's very
oh, okay.
But yeah, our midnight mass is from 12 a.m. to 2 a.m. So we do like a sinful theme.
Nice.
So we named them after Fallen Angels.
Okay.
That was delicious.
Ah,
very good. Okay.
And we're having no trouble
Laura.
Assimilating it. That's
the,
sure.
the best kind of angel. angel.
And I wrote low-key like L-O-W-K-E. Well, yeah. I'm mythologically challenged.
No, you're, just a low, you're a low-key guy.
I'm a low-key. Yeah, thank you.
And you're the other kind of low-key
I'm the
guy.
I prefer not to guy.
Well, Dave, we wanted to wrap up the Popo Galassini conversation.
Well, anyway, yeah, this guy, I mean, this guy's life was just, you know, he all of Southern California, all the changes it went through just kind of seemed to flow through him. He ends up at this little tiny bar in
Laguna Beach
where it turns out my father-in-law probably knew him. My late father-in-law knew all the bars in Laguna Beach. He was a high school history teacher and was not afraid of conviviality, and he must have known Popo at that bar, and then Popo lasted another year and then drove his car into a tree at age 80, almost 82,
and that was the end of him.
But I mean, you know, he tended bar in Southern California from around 1935 till 1981, and it just pops up everywhere when everything is going on. You know, it's very funny, and you see just all the transformations.
Do we think the Saturn kind of did that have any staying power beyond that?
Not until Jeff found
until you
it.
Rediscovered it, Jeff.
Yeah.
Think,
well, the only as Bob Esmino did have one newspaper clipping of. The three guys who went to Mallorca for the championship from California, and Popo was one of them. And it was like a really grainy, terrible picture of an old yellowed newspaper clipping that he let me Xerox. So the only thing I knew about him was that. And I knew that the drink, well, Dave also found this out in his research, the drink was originally called the X-15 because when he did that drink, he was working at the Outrigger in... was it Laguna or
no? Huntington Beach. Yeah,
and all of these scientists or engineers rather that were working on the X-15 rocket out there would drink at his bar.
Okay,
and so he named the drink in honor of them. And then the test pilot who was testing the X-15 died shortly before he went to Mallorca for the championship. So he changed the name to the Saturn.
Okay,
so
I got to correct like just a little bit.
Oh, okay,
because he actually. He'd already changed the name because he won the local competition in June with the Saturn. He changed it because Apollo 1 was made by North American Aviation, and Apollo 1, the capsule, was an absolute mess, and it burned on the launch
pad. That was the one that burned on the tarmac.
Yeah, on the tarmac. And it turns out there were all these design flaws. And so North American also made the X-15. And it was like there was a lot of like, no, we don't want to call it.
Okay,
that.
Okay.
So that was why he said he mentioned it was for political reasons. That's what it had to be.
Okay.
Yeah. It was that because he already had to change it before the test crash.
Uh huh.
That's really. It's like the not calling the Chevy Nova
exactly
Nova in Spanish speaking.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. It was just a bad omen.
Bad.
You know?
Right.
Let's move it to Saturn, which it turns out the Saturn rocket was made by the Rocketdyne division of North American. So it's the same damn thing.
Oh, yeah. Right. rebranding.
But nobody was mad at the rocket maker. So.
But to answer your question, as far as, I mean, if you'll forgive me for saying it this way, it kind of flamed out. The drink just flamed out. It won the award.
Okay.
It was on. I don't think it was even on his menu. I have a menu for the Outrigger, and the Saturn's not on it. Some of his other award-winning drinks are. So, no, I think it just... I mean, he made a splash with it, won an award, and then it just went away.
Yeah, that was like the last hurrah for tiki drinks also, like 1967.
In that end of that era.
Yeah, they were, you could see it fading, you know, and when he ends up at the Disneyland Hotel, it's like, okay. Because he had been like the tiki specialist among the Bartenders Guild people, or one of the two. There was another one too, also a Filipino.
But he was the big gun, though.
Who, you guys, in general during that time, today in an era where cocktail competitions are ubiquitous, we'll use that word. I'm not sure I know what it means, but I'll use it anyway. Who was sponsoring cocktail competitions? Were the brands at that time?
They were brands.
As well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Early Times would sponsor a lot of them. Yeah. Galliano later on.
Really?
Galliano's
there's a Christopher Columbus rum that sponsors one of these things, which was a six-year-old Puerto Rican rum. Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, their winner was the Columbus, which was a daiquiri with a little pineapple juice in it, as I recall.
Well, the other thing is these you go over these award-winning drinks, and many of them are just baffling as to why anybody would win with a drink like this. There was one that was bourbon and orange Curacao with a twist. that's your award winner?
So many of them are terrible. They're just awful drinks, and... There was, I mean, Bob Ismino told me there were rumors going around that a lot of the contests were rigged.
Which makes perfect sense.
If your bar burned through so many cases of such and such was sponsoring, then you probably would, you know, you'd win. So many drinks are just nauseating that one. Like, and they were all, in the 60s, they were all cream drinks.
Yeah.
Always cream drinks.
But then they got worse. You start looking in the early 70s and you see the standard of bartending has fallen so far. You know, there's all these artificial ingredients going into it. And these are contest winners by, like, the best bartenders in Southern California, supposedly.
That was the other Filipino guy who won, V. Bobby Batugo.
He was the guy who won all those
awards for drinks that used roses, lime juice, no fresh citrus.
Yeah.
According to Ismino, Mr. Ismino to me, Bobby Batugo popularized Midori and Bailey's.
Yeah.
Like those two things became big because he won awards for drinks that use them. And the drinks, I mean, I really wanted to put a couple of his award winners in my books because, A, they were, you know, interesting time travel specimens, and he was a famous guy, and I wanted to write about him. Bobby Batugo, but they just were terrible.
You're getting into the dark ages there, you know?
Yeah, they're really terrible.
You can really see, like, these recipes falling over the cliff. Some of the old-timers had some good recipes the year before, the 67. The 66 winner was a pretty good drink with, like, creme de cassis and... I think whiskey and a couple other things.
From the Half Penny Inn that was in Anaheim.
The Ambrosia, I think it was called. And that one looked good. And there were a couple others.
I made that one.
It
was in the same newspaper article that
And, you know, there are a couple of them that look good, you know, and then you just start to see, like, you see in the newspaper, they list all four winners and give you the recipes, and you're like, you know, from first place to fourth place, and they're just all terrible.
Yeah. So, like, moving to, like, frozen concentrate kind of stuff for fruit juice,
just about,
right?
Roses, and really unbalanced.
Yeah.
And they're only liqueurs. It's like liqueurs and cream and unsweetened liquor.
Yeah, like De Kuyper type liqueurs and that.
Yeah,
stuff
and no, like, whiskey, gin, rum,
sugar
or
shock,
like that.
Just sugar shock, and just lactic.
Very, and if there's rum, it's always white rum, you know, and it's never like anything with a lot of flavor to it. And it just goes on from there. And you really see that was the end of a culture. I mean, one of the guys that went to Disneyland, went to Japan with Galsini when he won in 73, I think it was, until 1968, had been a master sergeant in the Marines, and then he started bartending. So he'd been bartending for most, like, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And now he's the contest winner, and he's going off. And, you know, meanwhile, in the old Bartenders Guild days, that guy wouldn't have been even, you know, allowed to open a door for these guys.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys all had to have been bartending for 10 years and so on and so forth. There were all these regulations. And
well, you know, we got to take a break, guys, but strangely, it's like today where you bartend for 6 months and win an award, then you think you should run a bar. All right, I'm going to leave that
or alone. Represent a brand.
Or represent a brand, right, exactly. Yeah. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Deese here, WGSN 98. Goodbye, Joe. Wherever you may be, we are here at Belle Epoque. Thanks very much to those guys for hosting us. Come check them out. We'll run that down in a second. And chatting with Jeff Beachbum Berry and David Wondrich. And we're talking about, David, places that you have visited on your trip. And you actually got put to work, it sounds like, at Pablo's.
Well, our dear friend Pablo Johnson, a boulevardier about town, if ever there was, who seems to know most of the food establishment in this city, is a great photographer and famous for making red beans and rice at the drop of a hat. And he had his New Year's Day drop in, I will not make red beans and rice at the drop of a hat, and I cannot flip cornbread in a pan like he can with two hands, iron skillet in each hand, mm-hmm. flipping them perfectly mm-hmm. at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the man is skilled, but I will make punch, you know, no matter what. And
Didn't he write a book, Jeff, called Punch?
Well, Dave does make punch at the drop of a hat, which is really why everybody wears hats in this town, because if you drop it, you will get some punch.
Get some punch. Right.
If you wonder why everybody in Brooklyn wears a hat, now you know. Yeah.
Sorry, Dave.
So over the years, I won't say perfected, but I've become committed to making hotel room punch. Because I'll fly down to wherever I'm going. If I've got a social occasion, I'm going to bring punch because that's what I do. I bring a mason jar with me and a peeler, and I'll buy some lemons and some sugar, which I did at Rouse's on
Royal Street right here in the corner.
Yeah, we're on Royal Street, like late at night. So the Rouse's late at night is always something.
Mm-hmm.
I'll peel the lemons, put the peels in the jar with the sugar, leave them overnight. Next day, I'll juice the lemons. I brought a little juicer, came prepared, and I brought a bottle of booze that I pre-mixed in Brooklyn. This is my latest obsession, is Mexican rum, Chiranda, which is this, which you can get here, and it's this very grassy, bright, funky rum. They've been making rum in Mexico since the 1500s, and they used to make more of that than they did of mezcal. So it's really, it's an old Mexican spirit.
A lot like by Merida, right?
Also all the way up into Michoacán and around Veracruz and, you know, any of the mm-hmm. lowlands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mexico's got so many different geographical areas.
Mm-hmm.
They also make it in Oaxaca up in the hills where it's humid. So I mixed that 50-50 with mezcal, and I'm like, okay, let's make like a really better version of Mixto Tequila, which is bad sugar cane mixed with agave. Yeah, generally, you know, they're not putting the best stuff into the Mixto these days.
Right.
So this is like, let's make this really good. So I mixed that up and brought it over to Pablo's, and we were nipping on that. That's fun, and then also all kinds of. What I love. One of the things I love about traveling in the last few years is the local canned beers you get, because everything's local and they've got great graphics and it's always fun. I think we had the Reasonably Corrupt Ale. It was just kind of funny. The Hoodat Lager,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, okay, this is actually regional in a way that spirits and wine really aren't.
Mm-hmm.
But the beer is definitely regional.
So we did the beer and the punch.
No, we had that on the side.
Okay. I mean, where was that going?
Brian, you a man can't fly on one wing.
You're right. Making punch is thirsty work, Dave.
Yeah. But But I love doing the hotel room version. You know, it's like where you could do it. The maids look at you weird because there's a big bag of empty of squeezed out citrus in your garbage.
They were using the ice bucket for the punch bowl.
Well, I did go down and get ice from the ice machine to bring to Pablo's though.
Okay,
so I had crappy hotel ice. It was great.
Sweet,
but you know, it's just punch is easy to make. You just have to want to make it, and that's basically it. That's what I'm trying to say.
There you go. So it's transportable, right?
Yeah, it's transportable. You know, you could throw the booze and threw it in a seltzer bottle, plastic. You know, mixed it, pre-mixed it, and ready to go.
Do you want to tell us what mezcal and what?
I used a mix of mezcals because I didn't have enough of any one.
Okay, right.
And then I used Uruapan Charanda, which is this bright blue bottle, and it's quite lovely, and you can get it here. There are other brands, Paranubes, you can look for, which is very nice. That's not Charanda. Charanda is a regional Mexican rum, but that's also Paranubes is from Oaxaca, grows up in the clouds from Cane, and these are really just grassy, funky, bright rums made from sugarcane juice mostly, or half sugarcane juice and half molasses.
Okay,
so they're very bright and flavorful, and they mix absolutely amazingly well with tequila and mezcal.
It makes sense. Huh?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, where you get that sort of grassiness and that herbal is going to
yeah,
kind of cut
and,
through
and they really balance each other, and you make it, and you can get just a really tasty punch.
That sounds great.
It's like four parts of that. One part lemon juice, one part sugar. Peel some of the citrus and put it in a jar with the sugar overnight, and it'll pull out all the lemon oil from the peels. Don't use limes for that because it's kind of bitter.
Then it gets bitter.
But if you do this, then I just pour the juice into the jar again, seal it, and shake it, and it dissolves all the. All the sugar, and you're ready to go. Add water, as much water as you put in booze.
Bubble wrap and put it in your check luggage?
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're over the volume.
Yeah. Well, 1 liter. I only bring 1 liter. I just bring the booze, which is 1 liter.
Okay, yeah.
And then, I mean, that's enough. If you bring a liter of booze, that's enough for, 30 good glasses of punch. I mean, small, but good.
Sure.
That's enough for a party.
That's nice.
Well, maybe in your town.
Yeah, well, I, by party I mean six people.
Didn't we talk about avocado toast last time?
Yeah.
That's in New York, and it's just here. It's just a second glass of punch, Jeff.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, we got about a couple minutes left, you guys, where we got to kind of close out the portion. Not kind of. We have to close out the portion of the radio show. Let's do this. Let's, Jeff, tell people where they can find you at Latitude 29, your fine establishment, bar and restaurant.
Oh, yeah, that's on Peter Street, or you can enter through Decatur. We're in the Bienville House Hotel, and you can find us at latitude29nola.com, or you can find my site at beachbumberry.com.
And find your publications and all
yeah,
that stuff.
Yeah, the website can direct you to Cocktail Kingdom, which sells all the books and all the barware and all that good stuff.
And you survived Sippin' Santa, by the way, which is good to see.
That's always so much fun. Sippin' Santa was so much fun. Yeah. Now, that's another podcast, though, right?
Yeah, when we did that one leading in.
Oh, yeah, we did. That's
yeah,
right.
That's right.
Okay, so everybody knows about it. Yeah, worked. It was a lot of fun this year.
Yeah,
it's great.
Good. That's good. And good. And Dave, where do we find you on the Daily Beast?
I'm at the Daily Beast, and you can find me on Twitter. Where I spend far too much time.
You are one of the most prolific Twitter people. I don't. You are amazing.
Well, when I'm home, it means I'm chained to the computer writing, and so if I'm stuck on something, I'll just nip over there, and so I turn up there quite a bit at David Wandrich, and
your regular column at the Daily Beast.
At the Daily Beast, yeah, it's about twice a month.
Awesome.
They tend to be longer pieces. So,
and we're here at the old Absinthe House too, and I want to mention this really quick because you wrote an amazing four-part series that you just that started earlier in the
that's exactly
last
the kind
year
of thing
in 2019.
I do.
Yeah, and it's really fantastic stuff. We talked. You and I were on. You were on the show with me along with Laura a while back. But so go check that out because we talk about the amazing history of this particular space. Laura, what's the address here?
240.
So we are at 240 Bourbon Street at Bella Pock. Friends, come check them out. Open Thursday through Sunday from 4 till whenever. A super fine absinthe lounge great restaurant. Haley Van Fleet is the chef here. Fantastic food. Laura Bellucci, our good pal, is the beverage director here. And you need to come check them out. It's an historic space. It's a beautiful space. And great food and great drink. What we're going to do, friends, we're going to close out the portion of the radio show here. And Dave and Jeff are going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drakes, and we'll see what we get into. So remember, friends, be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until next time. Hey, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the program, friends, this week. As always, as we noted, our first of 2020. And we're about to pop right back over to Belle Epoque to continue our conversation with David Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry. Here we go. Up another shot with Nola Drinks, friends. Brian Diaz here with you. We are at Belle Epoque, the very fine Absinthe Lounge, 240 Bourbon Street. Come check them out, friends. It's a fantastic place, beautiful place. And I'm sitting here with my friends David Wondrich and Jeff Beachbum Berry. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Hey, it's a pleasure. It's good to have you in town, Dave. And Jeff, it's always a pleasure to see you here in town.
Well, it's always a pleasure to see you, too.
So. Oh, thank you very much. Now that we've dispensed the pleasantries four segments in, that's great.
This is the podcast. We're supposed to be nasty now.
Yeah, right. Good to see your fucking face again, Jeff. It's fantastic here on the podcast.
Careful. Fucking up motherfuckers is my game.
Ooh, way to go Dolomite on us. Very, very nice, man. Oh, man.
I love that movie.
That was
a new one. That was great.
That was fantastic, man.
Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it was really. It just kind of like kept progressing, right?
Yeah.
Where the story
just
kind of keeps going in a particular direction. Yeah, so if you don't have Netflix, you don't know what the hell we're talking about, but that's Eddie Murphy. Yeah, very good. Did you guys watch the Saturday Night Live that he hosted?
I watched some of it.
No. It was pretty good.
Yeah, I saw the Weekend Update. When he came on as Gumby.
Nice.
That was funny.
Yeah, Gumby, damn it.
Part of me was slightly hoping for a little bit of a Joe Piscopo. appearance right there just to do the Frank Sinatra and Gumby bit.
I don't think anybody really gets along with Joe Piscopo anymore.
I kind of get that impression. Well, he's on it, actually. Isn't he on AM radio in New York City, I think?
Is he?
I think so.
I haven't listened to AM radio in New York City in the longest time.
Okay, fair enough. There you go.
I mean...
And now, in part, you're on AM radio here in New Orleans.
Yeah, but that's New Orleans.
But he doesn't have to listen to it.
Yeah. Also, you know, that's not New York City. You think you got sore heads.
Oh, jeez. Man, I'm not going to even go there with the radio station I'm on. Pause. All right. Cool. Yeah. So Dave, where else? Because we're using your experience.
Okay, yeah.
You know, Jeff and I are denizens here, so we're using your experience.
Let's see, where have I been?
Denizens, I like that.
Yeah. I'm not sure I know what that means either, but...
Sure beats shiftless.
It doesn't mean...
Idle. Notorious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I went to the Elysian Bar, which was quite lovely for a drink. We went, I've been to Jewel of the South, where we saw not just Chris Hanna, but Paul Gustings, two of the OG New Orleans bartenders, if ever there were. Where else have I been?
Both members of the Hair Club for Men.
Along with Popo Galsini.
Along with Popo.
But oh, Lord, you know, yeah. Where else have I been? Brennan's.
Okay.
Lou Brow, the, you know, the wonderful bartender at Brennan's Bar. I mean, you can go into Brennan's and just sit at the bar, and you will have an absolutely spectacularly pleasant time at that little bar.
Let me ask you this question, you guys, because this is going to be kind of random, but I was just thinking about it because I made one this morning on my way over here.
Yeah.
Because we come from the North Shore. I'll leave that alone, too. The Bullshot.
I love that drink.
I love that drink too, Dave, and I've kind of been into it for a while. And actually, we were speaking of Paul Gustings. When he was at Broussard's, there was one on the menu that I think was actually not by Paul. It was by the general manager, who is now like three general managers removed from Broussard's, which is only like 8 months ago. No, it's longer than that, but 3 months ago.
Oh, Broussard's.
But Paul told me kind of, and then I kind of reversed engineered it. But those drinks, I mean, I love a Bullshot, but those drinks are sort of bouillon. Mm-hmm. Base drinks. That was like a thing in the 50s, right?
It was invented in the 50s at the Caucus Club in Detroit when an advertising guy is talking to Lester Gruber, the legendary owner. Lester Gruber was one of those guys who like had the biggest wine cellar in, you know, in the Midwest, and traveled to Europe every year looking for ideas for his restaurant, for his steakhouse in Detroit. And he had the London Steakhouse. And across the street was the Caucus Club, and that was his like more loungy bar. Barbara Streisand got her first big break there. And really? Lester Gruber's talking with an advertising guy who had just moved to Detroit, and the guy goes, "Well, now they've got me trying to sell Campbell's canned broth."
The Frisky Sour.
Yeah.
Have you seen the ad for the Frisky Sour?
I haven't.
Oh my God, I got to send you guys this.
Yeah, what is it?
It's a Campbell's soup ad, full page magazine ad for a drink in a flute called the Frisky Sour. And it's Campbell's beef soup with lemon juice and a dash of something. I don't remember what it was, but it sounded absolutely like punishment.
Yeah,
You know, just like,
that does not sound good.
No, but it was like amazing. Like, you know, just to see that.
Well, I mean, they were trying to push that stuff.
Yeah, I thought it was like a fake. I thought it was like The Onion or something, but no, it's real. You know, it's like it was real.
Wow. Well, the Bullshot actually worked.
Yeah. Well, was that originally called Ox on the Rocks?
There were a number of different names, but I think they called it the Bullshot, and Campbell's was like, you can't do that. You know, that's not family friendly.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's too much like bullshit, which is what makes it funny. And so so they said, well, we'll try Ox on the Rocks. And they tried a bunch of different names, and none of those caught. And meanwhile, the real name leaked out, and that's how people were ordering it. And, you know, it's funny. It was one of those freak drinks that people ordered to show that they were sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
For a while there, it's like, they'd go to the bartender, "Do you have any beef bouillon?" You know, and the bartender would go, "Oh, I got you hooked up."
And
then the really sophisticated people like Marilyn Monroe were like, "No, who would do that to good vodka?"
You know, Noel Coward.
Yeah, Noel Coward.
That
other
was his
people
favorite,
did.
That was
but
his
Marilyn
favorite
Monroe
drink.
Just thought it was ridiculous.
As she should.
But on the other hand, I like that drink.
Yeah,
I can't help it.
You know who? Well, Dale DeGroff likes it too.
Yeah, he's
like, I first heard the Bullshot when I was just watching an old movie on TV when I was a kid, David Hemmings in a Jackie Suzanne thing.
Okay.
It was either the one about Robin Stone moving on. This is some totally forgettable, trashy movie. But they were at the Peacock Alley in, and they name checked it. You know, this is a very famous hipster bar in the Waldorf Astoria in the 60s where all the media crowd hung out. And David Hemmings played this ad exec in a really cool Carnaby Street suit, and walks in and orders a Bullshot.
Ah,
okay. And that's as far as I knew anything about it until I started researching potions, and I found out that it was Noel Coward's favorite drink.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's like
there's also a reference. I mean, how I had actually heard of the drink and why it stuck with me was there's a reference to it in Caddyshack.
Is it really?
When Roddy Dangerfield's in the country club bar for the banquet, and he walks up to the kid who's kind of, you know, the bad guy caddy, but who's also tending bar, And he says, and I'll leave part of this out, but he said, can you make a bull shot? Rodney Dangerfield says to the kid. And the kid says, can you make a shoe smell? And I thought that I used to watch that movie with my dad. That's so funny. I thought that was like the funniest thing ever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then some years later, you know, actually at Broussard's, a bull shot on the menu.
Oh, that's funny. That's
and
funny.
So I had to order it. And then the way they made it, and this is why I brought up Brendan specifically, yeah, David, because they have one on the menu there as well, but it's very, very different. It's actually much lighter.
Yeah, it's artisanal, you know.
Yeah, and much lighter, yeah, as opposed to just like spoonfuls of bouillon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the original one has its place in the annals of funky drinking.
What would be the original spec on that?
Well, it was a Bloody Mary with bouillon instead of the tomato juice. Originally, at the Caucus Club, they had their own spice mix, but that died with the Caucus Club.
Well, okay. Yeah, and the American version, the one you were talking about, the Camel Soup one, was just like a bouillon cube, right? Just with hot water.
No, it was from the can. It was canned bouillon.
Canned bouillon. Okay,
yeah.
So that's thicker, right?
Yeah,
that's like
canned beef broth. It's canned consomme, really.
Yeah, it's canned consomme.
Yeah. Which is the same thing as the frisky sour. Because when I found an old piece of video, it was a documentary about Noel Coward, and they actually had his favorite bartender, who had since retired from the American Bar at the Savoy, making the bull shot the way Noel Coward
liked. Oh, that's funny.
It. Yeah, and the consomme, it was thick. It was like it was like pea soup or something.
Yeah. Well, because the stuff is jellied.
Yeah,
you know,
it's jellied consomme.
Yeah,
that's right.
And so you got to shake the bejesus out of it.
Yeah,
but
let me tell you guys, because here's how I do it, kind of reverse engineering the Broussard's one, because I wanted that thickness, and that's how that was. Is using the same kind of idea, the consomme, where you take the better than bouillon, the jarred gelatin stuff, the roast beef one, four oversized tablespoons or teaspoons, of that in a cup of water.
Right.
So you're probably about five teaspoons. And then make celery puree instead of celery salt, which I think was the original concept. But celery puree, but then I put lemon juice in it because it keeps that from oxidizing.
Mm-hmm.
And then two ounces of the bouillon, 2 ounces of vodka, an ounce of the celery puree with lemon, Worcestershire sauce, hearty dashes, and then I put a little ponzu in it because it brings a little citrus to it. But you get that thick, cloudy kind of thing that I kind of want in the drink, as opposed to like a thin.
That actually sounds like
drink. It's actually pretty
good.
I mean,
it's soupy.
That's a lot more complicated than how I make mine.
Okay, how do you do yours?
Can you make me a bull shot, please?
Yeah, can you make a shoe smell? Can you make a shoe smell, Dave?
Yeah. I can make a shoe smell, believe me.
I love it when Ken Chef comes into the show. So I find this really thank you for indulging me on the conversation about the bull shot. I've always been curious about the drink.
Yours sounds like a better drink. The potential for a really good umami-style drink is – I mean, I'm sure that there's that Umami Mary at the Japanese bar in Bargoto. Which is an amazing drink, and it's very, very – I mean, they must put – MSG in it. That's how delicious it is, you know. And the bullshit has a potential to be something like that.
Yeah, you could really. I mean, I could see. I would use maybe like what's that Kikori Japanese whiskey they're calling it? It's basically a barley shochu at a higher proof.
Okay.
So it's got some of that umami in it already.
I might
spice it up with a little bit of baijiu just to be crazy, and then put in a spicy broth. Spicy beef broth. That would be pretty good. I mean, there are things you could do with that.
There's a Jamaican version that's really hard to take,
yeah.
At least for me with my delicate constitution. It's called the, I believe it's called the Angry Bull, and it's you make it with overproof Ray and Nephew rum instead of vodka, and you use pica pepper sauce. In it, and it's like a, again, it's a punishment drink.
You know? That'll mess you up.
Yeah,
that'll mess you up, but you know, in a pleasant way.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You get to drinking in Jamaica, you know.
It's I mean, I'm fascinated by this idea that like the sort of the bull shot permeated then, and we have all these sort of cross boundary versions of it, because it seemed to me like these sort of bouillon drinks came
and
went.
It was a really big drink for a while there. I mean, it really was.
It had its moment.
It was popular from like about 1958 to probably about 1968.
That's a long moment.
It's a long moment.
Yeah,
and it was
moment.
Really popular. And you know, you could still order it at like Joe Allen in the Theater District in New York, which is a theatrical restaurant where they've got long memories and people with particular tastes. I bet I could get them to do one at the upstairs bar at Sardi's, which where I like to drink in New York, which is one of the great sporty scenes of anywhere in New York. Amazing bunch of regulars at, you know, Sardi's is in the Theater District, and all the theater people drink. They have a downstairs bar that is on the street, and that looks like where the real action should be there, but there's an upstairs bar where the real action is, because there's no decor up there. There's just drinkers.
We don't need the distraction.
No, right? No. We don't need to see and be seen. We just need, and this is the kind of place where somebody
wall garnish.
Walks in and the bartender looks at them and turns around and there's their drink in front of them.
Right.
It's like, you better, you know me, you know what I drink.
I like that kind of place.
Yeah, it's a very New York and New Orleans sort of bend together in some aspects, and that's one of them. The upstairs bar at Sardi's would be right at home here in New Orleans.
Got it.
And everybody in it.
Got it. Awesome.
That would be great.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, what's going on at Latitude 29 these days? There's an open-ended question now that Sippin' Santa's over and coming into the new year.
Well, we do our menu once a year. After 5 years, it changes very little. The first couple of years, when I was kind of finding my sea legs about about the menu, there were some things that were moved around or cut or replaced, just simply because the clientele was telling me what I needed to do by what they were not ordering,
right?
or by what they were. One of the things, I did have some stick. This is a very long answer to a short question, but hey, it's a podcast.
Yeah, and it was an open-ended question. What's going on at Latitude
29?
Well,
what's going on
days?
I'm going to be tweaking the menu. We always tweak it before Tales of the Cocktail, and because it's expensive to change our menu because it's full-color printing and it costs a lot of money, so we only do it once a year. And I subscribe to the Trader Vic theory of menus. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I do not believe in seasonal menus. If you have a good drink and somebody comes to New Orleans once a year, they'll expect that drink. And nothing worse than going to your favorite bar with a bunch of people to say, you've got to try this drink. It's absolutely amazing. It'll knock your socks off and the menu's changed.
Yeah.
And, and it's not there anymore.
I mean, I think bars too often do change too much. They don't have a signature drink.
Right.
Like, what the hell?
Right.
Every famous bar ever has had a signature drink.
Right.
The thing that's always on the menu that brings people in. You know, it's like people are just leaving money on the table, it looks like.
Because last time you guys were on together, after Tales, you did the seminar talking about cocktail menus.
We talked about this too.
And
we kind of
touched on that a little bit, of this idea of people looking for familiarity, and then that sort of number, I can't remember if we said this on the air or off the air, but what a lot of people anecdotally tell me, what's in your signature drink list, at least in this town, is 80-90% of what people order in a bar.
Yeah. So, actually, speaking of Sippin' Santa, there was one drink that Brad Smith came up with. We called it the Christmas Eve of Destruction.
That was great. I love that.
What
was a great drink.
That was my contribution, was the name.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good contribution.
Thank you, sir.
That was great. How old is Brad, by the way?
It's hard to tell with his shaved head, but I think he's about pushing 40. Maybe he's in
the 40s. Because I was surprised. Because the name of the song would be with Eve of Destruction. But
Well, I normally all my references are way out of date. I would be the worst, piano lounge comedian because I'd still be doing Godfather impressions.
We talked about Maynard G. Krebs.
We did indeed. Exactly. So there you go. There you go. Eve of Destruction was also a fairly recent science fiction movie based on a video game.
So when I did an interview
with the wine show, the older gentleman, and he said, "Hey, Barry Maguire, that was a great reference." And that's not really what it was. For once.
Well, I thought it was Barry Maguire. Okay,
I do a lot of lecturing with Dale DeGroff, and it's always like, Dale,
you have
he
to
gets
translate
into something.
For
and he's going to a room full of 20-year-old bartenders. He's going, "Well, this is the Rainbow Room was designed by Norman Bel Geddes, Barbara Bel Geddes' dad."
That's a good guess.
And then the bartenders are going, Norman and Barbara.
Who?
And then all the phones come out. And
How do you spell Valgame?
I mean, Lanine, that's why I always like it when Lanine's sitting with me in a seminar, because she'll come up to me after and says, nobody knows who the fuck you're talking about. Just stop it. Stop trying to make references to anything. You know, just pretend that pretend you're speaking a different language and it's being translated. You know, it's just like
I just try to explain myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, you know, that means you go on for 40 minutes.
Well, the thing is, the editor of Potions.
Mm-hmm.
The editor the same editor of the Cocktail Kingdoms guy. Really lovely guy. Great guy. We got along well. But he was constantly telling me, look, this is your 10-year edition. You can, and you're putting footnotes in.
Yeah.
You need a footnote here. It's like, why? Why should I have to explain who Victor McLaughlin is? Everybody knows who that is. And I was like, no, they don't.
No, they don't. Yeah.
Like, and why should I have to explain who Henry Kaiser was? It's like, just put the footnote. And I'm very glad he did.
You know, yeah,
like first of all, it upped the page count, which is always good.
Always good.
When you're trying to minimize the amount of work you're doing.
Well, see, you know, I had almost 20 years of writing for Esquire. And it's like, if you're going to introduce somebody, I always put a little tag on them, you know?
Yeah,
who was this person?
Right.
Just briefly, you know, just in a couple words, so people aren't completely lost. And that's because my editors always made me do that. And that was good editing. You could do it so it's almost seamless.
There were times when the footnotes totally backfired, because I was trying to explain this one restaurateur who was also an actor. Mm-hmm. Somebody Fong, and he appeared as a character actor in Charlie Chan movies, Herbie the Love Bug, and something else like that. So I put that in the footnote, and I got a call from the other going, nobody knows who those things are. It's like, well, it's a footnote explaining who he is. Yeah. What do you want me to do? Do a footnote to the footnote? He said, it's a useless footnote. Take it out. I was like, cool. All right.
All right.
You know. I was saying, you end up with Don Knotts in your head. It has nothing to do with anything.
He's present in the most important scene in The Amazing Mr. Limpet.
And Don Knotts, by the way, Don Knotts told me a hilarious story. I met Don Knotts because this was in Escondido, California.
Ooh.
And he did a live show where he was just Q&A with the most suburban town ever. I had a friend who lived there, and he said, hey, Don Knotts is coming. So we all wanted to get our reluctant astronaut still signed, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Was this at the Half Moon Saloon by chance in Escondido?
No. It's in their municipal theater.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it was a big deal.
Yeah. So so I had actually met one of his screenwriters at a little Writers Guild thing. It was this ancient dude sitting next to me. We started talking, and he said, what have you done? I said, I haven't done shit. And I said, what have you done? And he starts talking about all these Don Knotts movies. He's like, really? Yeah. I wrote for the Andy Griffith shows. Oh, my God. So he starts telling me Don Knotts stories. And then I go to see Don Knotts, and I mention him, and he goes, Don Knotts goes, Emmett? You're talking about Emmett's great. Oh, say hello to Emmett for me. You know what Emmett did to me once? And he starts telling the story about when they were researching the reluctant astronaut, they were having dinner with Wernher von Braun.
Oh, my God.
And so they were sitting, they were taking their seats to have dinner with him, and Don Knotts says to Wernher von Braun, well, don't sit next to Emmett. He's Jewish.
I love that.
Now, the best part about that, we've just aged ourselves out of it with this podcast. Nobody knows.
Okay, now we need let's get a footnote for Wernher von Braun, a footnote for the Andy Griffith Show,
Don Knotts.
Footnote for Don Knotts, footnote for the reluctant astronaut. We'll be here all day.
Footnote for astronauts.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that Matt Damon played one.
Oh, that's right. Okay, we're on. Matt who?
We talked about X-15 rockets, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, go back and, you know, Google's your friend. You can Google half the show we just talked about on the show and figure
that was
out,
my
right?
argument with – that was my only argument I had with the editor is that if somebody doesn't know what something is, now they can just
– they can find it.
Yeah, if they want to, you know, so.
Absolutely.
And the one thing I don't like about footnotes is sometimes it interrupts – this sound really pretentious, but it interrupts the flow of your prose if you care about such things.
Yeah, but,
you know, it's like
– I mean – because I don't get footnotes on the web, I always just put it in huge. I shovel so much crap into my sentences.
Well, you show your work.
Yeah, yeah. And I shovel it all in there, and you know there is no flow, but it's because I don't have footnotes. If I had footnotes, half of my pieces would be in the footnotes. Well,
and like you're talking about Jeff, like you know, as someone who was a history major as an undergraduate, when you're reading a history treatise, and half the page is footnotes.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, do I look at that or do I move on? Do
Dave,
I come back
I've
to the
pages
chapter?
Where there's two lines of text and the rest are footnotes.
Dave has a flow, but it's a very Edwardian journalist flow.
It is.
It's a lot of. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who wrote his scandalous memoirs. Around, okay, senior moment. Let's move on. Anyway, Dave definitely has a flow. It's just not a 21st century flow.
It's not for people with short attention span stuff. And that's why you broke up the piece that you did on this space into four parts.
I needed to keep researching it also. You
Dave,
know?
That's why you broke it up into four parts, exactly. Was to make it easier reading.
Exactly.
Not that you needed to do more research, man.
No, but once you get into it, it's like reading Henry James. There's a certain kind of poetry to it. There's subjunctive clauses on subjunctive clauses. You just get into this. And it always takes you where you need to go, and I love the way you write. Actually,
well, thank you.
And it's far less complicated than James Joyce. You're not dropping names that at least I don't know who they are, or you don't explain
I try not
who
to.
They are.
Well,
I
he's
try not to.
And Dave punctuates. Unlike Dave, Mr.
I do punctuate.
Unlike Mr. Joyce,
I punctuate the fuck out of it.
Yes.
It's like I've got a shotgun and I'm standing back. Let me
shoot commas.
It's a 30 gauge comma shooter.
I'm leaning back there. I've got it braced at my shoulder.
Scattershot of commas.
I got a chamber loaded with ellipses.
Yeah.
Back off.
Just all over the goddamn thing.
Let's do this, you guys, because Jeff, you got a meter to feed.
Yeah,
and I got a family to feed.
And you got a family to feed, Dave. So one more time, Dave, tell people where they can find you, Daily Beast, and publications and all that
good
stuff.
Yeah, mostly Daily Beast these days, or you can track down my book, Imbibe, which is, believe it or not, still in print, or even more unbelievable, Punch, which is still in print because we haven't sold out the first print run, I think.
Those are great books, by the way,
and,
with lots of good punctuation.
And otherwise, the Daily Beast on an irregular but not too infrequent basis.
Awesome. Cool. We just go Daily Beast.
Yeah, Daily Beast half full is the half food full. And drink section,
also,
and I'm in there.
Because Dave doesn't really exist on the self-promotional plane. I would also like to say that he has his own podcast, which you should check out.
Oh, that's true. We've got Life Behind Bars with me and my well-informed and amusing editor, Noah Rothbaum.
The lovely and talented Noah Rothbaum.
Yeah, the lovely and talented Noah Rothbaum, where we basically just shoot the shit about booze issues and talk about whiskey a lot.
Well, these are two good subjects.
And also, you have a nutmeg grater out now with Cocktail Kingdom.
Yeah, I've got a line of barware at Cocktail Kingdom of recreations or inspired by the high-quality stuff that Greg Bohm, the demon collector behind Cocktail Kingdom, and I have been coveting for years. And we said, let's see if we can make some of this stuff. So everything is silver-plated, made out of rare alloys, and it's all high-quality stuff. Some of it is expensive as a result, but it looks good, and it's silver-plated.
And it will hold up then.
Right? We certainly hope so. Yeah. We're working on I'm working on destructive testing right now.
give it to our head bartender, Brad. Yeah. Brad is the Samsonite gorilla. Here's another footnoted thing. Look it up.
Yeah.
He has broken more barware. He has broken jiggers. I don't know how he does it.
I don't know how he does it. Force of mind. He's like Uri Geller. Yeah. Look it up.
He will just tear anything apart. So if you need to stress test anything, send one to Brad.
Brad Smith. We're calling out Brad Smith here. And Jeff, Latitude 29. And since we brought up our good friend Greg Bohm from Cocktail Kingdom, you also have a wonderful branded line of products that we should shill right here.
With Greg Bohm, one of the good ones out there.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons why the human race should not be extinct. love that guy.
I wouldn't go that far.
That's a lot of pressure on Greg.
No, I just mean the human race.
Oh,
part.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say
he's fine. The rest of us, I don't know.
Yeah. I was a little prone to hyperbole there. But anyway, he is one of the good ones, and he has put out a line of tiki barware with me. Everything from the most useless single-purpose product, like the Navy Grog Ice Cone, to others that have more uses, like a nice metal tiki julep cup and pearl diver glasses and all kinds of arcana that only Greg would be willing to resurrect. You know? Of course, now the Chinese are ripping it all off, but you know, somebody had to do it first.
So 240 Bourbon Street, we are here at Bella Pock on an awkward moment of closure here on the Noah Drink Show. That's what we do. check out Bella Pock Thursday through Sunday from 4 till whenever, right, Laura?
6
till whenever. Oh, I thought it was 4. Okay, 6 till whenever. Got it. 240 Bourbon Street. A fine absinthe lounge. We corrected ourselves here. Go check them out. Jeff, Dave, good to see you guys. Thanks so much.
You too. Thank you so much. Great.
See you too, sir.
Thank you. And hey, friends, I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show this week, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, a quick programming note. Our show next week, episode number 2 of January 2020, is going to be talking about the Turning Tables program here in New Orleans, started in part by a grant from Tales of the Cocktail, their education foundation. And the idea is to train persons of color here in New Orleans to become professional bartenders, and to not only give them the skills to actually tend bar, but also give them the skills to interview and some job placement stuff. And as we'll talk about in the interview, we have a high unemployment rate of persons of color in New Orleans, particularly African Americans. And yet at the same time in the hospitality industry, and in particular in the bar world, we have a shortage of labor. So right program at the right time with the right cause. And my good friend Ture Folks, who is the program director among a couple students and one of their mentors, will join us. So be sure to check that one out. Part of our ongoing sustainability series, which you can see on our website at noladrinks.com. Friends, here's our parting shot for the show. And also want to thank Dave Wondrich and Jeff Beachbump-Berry, my friends, for joining us on this week's show. I always appreciate their time, especially good old Dave, who is in town on vacation and carved out a little time for us to sit down there in Bella Pock and have a fun conversation like we do. And sort of speaking of Bella Pock, I want to give a big shout out to our good friend, this is part of the parting shot here, Laura Bellucci, who is the bar director there, and the rest of the team at Bella Pock. And we went over the first drink during the show that Laura was kind enough to give us, satiate our thirst with, if you will, while we were talking. And we were certainly talking, weren't we? But then the second drink, which I didn't really get to, is a really cool drink that she came up with. And this will be the point of the parting shot here in just a second. But she calls it the tremblement de terre, which means earthquake in French. And it's a riff on a drink that Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec used to drink. Apparently what he used to do, of course, the famous French artist who passed away, I think right at the very beginning of the 20th century, so 19th century French artist. He used to louche, apparently, his absinthe with cognac, and he called it the tremblement de terre. So I got to try that next time. But so she created sort of a riff on that idea. She uses the name tremblement de terre, but what it is it's an espresso, absinthe, orgeat syrup, and cognac. And it was just a nice little pour of espresso with those flavorings going on with the absinthe, the orgeat, and of course the cognac, as I mentioned. And that's what she calls the tremblement de terre. So there you go. That was the drink. And here's the point of the parting shot is, I think we talked about this a little bit when we did a show in early December that I invite you to go check out, that actually Dave Wondrich was on by phone. And Laura joined us for a segment that we also taped in Bella Pock, talking primarily about the history of Old Absinthe House, the historic bar there located at 240 Bourbon Street that plays an integral role, I'll let you go listen to that show, in the history of New Orleans drinking culture. And now Bella Pock, the fine absinthe lounge, which sits behind the Old Absinthe House bar in what used to be the Tony Moran's, if you're familiar with the area, the Italian Creole Italian restaurant in their dining room area. Okay, quick summary there of the show from early December. But we talked a little bit with Laura about the world of absinthe and kind of what's gone on. We've done shows on that in the past too. But I think Laura's drink, the tremblement de terre, is a very interesting example of this, that, you know, sparing you the long story of absinthe and how absinthe is now back out on the market and how that all came to be, go listen to some of our previous shows on that or go look it up online. But what we had is, I think we had a few brands that, you know,
were around when it came back onto the market, both in the Europe and in Europe, in the old world and in the new world in the United States. But very small number of brands, right? Now what we've seen, particularly in the new world, is a proliferation of brands. And what those different brands bring, of course, are different flavor profiles. Now, sort of parallel to this, I think when we saw Absinthe come back into the market space, is when you would go to a bar that happened to have Absinthe, and yes, we do have a fair bit of it, you know, places that serve it in New Orleans, and there are other places around. It's not as widespread as it is here in most places, or in the case of most places. But, you know, people were basically, as you would think they would, going back to classic Absinthe cocktails, the Absinthe Frappe, for example, or just simply the Absinthe drip with cold water and maybe a sugar cube as kind of a standard approach. Now what I think, by virtue of us having these different brands out there and therefore these different flavor profiles, these different expressions out there, you see very creative bartenders like Miss Laura Bellucci, our good friend, taking it to a new level. I think we're in a new era of Absinthe. Some have pointed out that the Absinthe category, since it came back, has been rather flat. That may be the case. I think there's a long way to go in growing the market space or the market share of Absinthe, but there are a dedicated cadre of fans out there that understand what it is, understand what it is not. And again, go listen to the show in December. And then taking it now to a new level, which is what I think we're seeing. So what I mean by that is we are actually seeing new cocktails being created using Absinthe as a base ingredient or even a modifier in very, very creative ways. I think it is an exciting new era out there in the world of Absinthe. And so what I would encourage you to do is go check out some of these different brands that are out there on the market these days. Go ask your local bottle shop for them. Give different things a try. Find some recipes online. Go to a bar. See what their programs are. And certainly, friends, if you are living in New Orleans or the area or are planning on visiting New Orleans or the area, be sure to go check out Laura and the team at Belle Epoque. Check out their extensive Absinthe list and check out her classic and her new era Absinthe cocktails. So there you go. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.